Approximately 1000 BC, the people of the nation Israel decided they wanted to be like the other nations. They looked around and they said, "We don't have an earthly king. Oh, how wonderful it would be to have a majestic king that walked in front of us, that led us out into battle. Someone we could look at, someone we could see, something concrete before us." And they wanted a king. Samuel tried to warn them. God told Samuel to warn them, and Samuel did. God said, if you want a king, you can have a king. But it's not a very wise thing to do. But they wanted a king. See, they had a king. That's the real irony in that, and that's the real tell in it. They had a king. His name was Yahweh. He wasn't this king that went before them as other nations, because other nations just had a man to go before them, a mortal. They had the living God of the universe as their king. But they wanted to be like other nations. Well, for a little over 500 years, the nation Israel was ruled by kings. The first three kings had long tenures as king. They had Saul that never could quite get a handle on what it was to be a king under Yahweh. It wasn't a bad guy in many ways. And compared to other kings that followed, Saul was really a very good king. But Saul struggled with issues. You know, confidence, a trust in Yahweh as opposed to himself. And we perhaps judge Saul too harshly often because we compare him in that time frame of what was being expected of him, which is appropriate because that's the way Scripture judges him. If we were to compare Saul to the kings that were to follow, Saul is up there much higher. But Saul was not the king that God wanted. Saul was not the man whom God was going to build his nation upon and the dynasty to follow. And so God looked out and he saw a young man, a boy in fact, and he said, that's the king. He has a heart after God. He has a heart after God's own heart. He looks inwardly. While everybody else was looking at Saul, and Saul was described as standing, his shoulders were where everybody else's head was. And people looked up. Saul was up there. He was good looking. Saul had everything that people wanted in a king. But God looked at David's heart. And David being the inferior little brother, even within the family couldn't see David as being king. But David was set to be king. And unlike other kings that we know of, David was appointed to be king while there was still a king on the throne. And David waited his turn. He waited and waited. He had opportunities to kill Saul and take the kingdom. But David's perspective was, no, God has appointed Saul to be king. Who am I to take his life? Eventually, David became king, and David was a great king. David was not a perfect man by any means. And Scripture does not hesitate to point out the failures of David. But in all of that, David never pursued other gods. Never pursued other gods. And David is viewed as a great, great king. Following David would come his son Solomon. And there was, you know, some issues that as David's death was approaching, and some son, you know, one son tries to become king, points himself, and goes through some issues. But finally, Solomon is the king. And Solomon saw, or under Solomon, the kingdom rose to a height that was unprecedented. As his death was just almost immediate, he charged his son Solomon, saying, "I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself to be a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, to keep His statutes, His commandments, His ordinances, His testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, and you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn. So the Lord may carry out His promise which He has spoken concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful of their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel." Then early in Solomon's reign, Solomon prayed, and God's response was, "Because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, and nor have you asked for riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will be no one, so there's been no one like you before you, nor shall there be any arise after you. I have also given you what you have not asked for, riches and honor." Goes on to say, you know, in chapter 4 of 1 Kings, of how Solomon's rule over all the kingdoms and how expansive that was, and that men from all the peoples came to hear Solomon, because everybody in the world had heard of his greatness. And then he began to build the house. It says in chapter 6 that it was 480th year after the nation had come out of the land of Egypt that he began to build the house of the Lord. And it happened when the priest came from the holy place, the cloud filled the house of the Lord in chapter 8. So the priest could not stand to minister because the cloud for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So the temple was built. And the Shekinah glory came down into that temple. God Himself was present in that temple in a way that He hadn't been present before. In a way that He had been present in the tabernacle, a temporary structure that was moving around, but now there was a permanent place. God had stamped His name upon Israel. He had stamped His name upon the land and upon the city of Jerusalem, and now He resided in the temple. And there's an incredible prayer of dedication in chapter 8, taking up about 30 verses in the Bible. And then it follows with an exhortation by Samuel to the people. You know, the temple is this special place, a place where God is. It's a place to turn. It's a place of prayer. It's a place to direct yourself to God who's there, that He might intervene. And that's what He does through this prayer. He acknowledges that over and over. For example, behold the heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, and how much less this house that I built. Okay, it's a temple, and we say this kind of glory indwells it and God resides there, but Solomon realizes it doesn't contain you. You're not a God that can be contained in a building. And he says later, listen to the supplications of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray toward this place here in heaven. And then he says, here in heaven, and again. And see, the temple becomes a place of prayer, a place to direct prayer, because it's a location, if you would, of Yahweh. But Solomon knows Yahweh's not residing there in totality. And he sees it much broader than that. He says, when the prayers come toward the temple, God in heaven hear. You know, it's an incredible time. David wasn't to be the architect of the temple, but David built everything. He amassed the fortune and all the provisions and had all the plans. And it was on Solomon to build it, though. After that dedication, he exhorts the people, blessed be the Lord who has given rest to His people Israel according to all that He's promised. Not one word has failed of all of His good promise, which He promised through Moses, His servant. May the Lord our God be with us, as He was with our fathers. May He not leave us or forsake us, that He may incline our hearts to Himself, to walk in all His ways and to keep His commandments and His statutes and His ordinances, which He commanded our fathers. And may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night, that He may maintain the cause of His servant and the cause of His people Israel as each day requires. So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God, there is no one else. Let your heart therefore be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in His statutes and to keep His commandments as at this day. Chapter 9 says, after all this building had taken place and everything had occurred here, that God appeared to Solomon a second time. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication which you have made before me. And I have consecrated this house which I have built by putting my name on it. As for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked in integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom, as I promised to David. But if you or your son shall indeed turn away from following me, if you shall turn away, then later he says, then I will cut off Israel from the land. And this house will become a heap of ruins. And everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done this to the land and to His house? And they shall say, because they forsook the Lord their God. And they worshipped other gods and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought adversity upon them. I mean, here is one of the grandest moments, perhaps the greatest moment in Israel's history. The temple is built. God dwells in the temple. They are secure. They have a king that asked for wisdom and discernment, and he was given that. But God warns them, don't forsake me. For if you turn away to other gods, this great building will just become a pile of rocks. Well, from there, David, chapter 10, tells us, so King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. All the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom with which God had put in his heart. And people kept bringing stuff to him year by year. But in chapter 11, a great decline starts. 1 Kings 11. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, and goes through several, all from different nations, concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them. And it's not so much that God just didn't like women from other nations as it was that those women would bring with them their gods. You shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after other gods. But Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives. You know, that's a lot of turning your heart away. For it came about when Solomon was old, in verse 4, his wives turned his heart away after other gods. And his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. And then it lists, you know, he goes after other gods. In verse 6, Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully as David had done. So David was wholly devoted. David followed the Lord fully. But when Solomon was old, his heart was turned away. Verse 8, thus also he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense, or he built high places. David, Solomon had just gone a different way. Chapter 9, or verse 9 and following is when the judgment comes. The judgment is that the nation will be torn in two because of his promises to David. A small section, Judah, concerning Jerusalem, that little bitty area will still be reserved. But a new nation is formed, Israel. But unfortunately, every king in Israel was evil. It would last for a couple of hundred years and go into exile. But in the nation of Judah, the small remnant that was left, there would be three kings. Three kings. If you include David, that's four kings. 500 years. Approximately 23 kings will rule Judah. Three when it's still united, about 20 when it's divided. And only four were really devoted to God. Three kings had the traits of David. And that's what we want to focus on this morning. These three kings and the key traits they had. The first was Asa, We find him in 1 Kings 15. 1 Kings 15. Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. The heart of Asa was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. And we noticed just in the verses before that we read that David was wholly devoted, but Solomon left that. This concept for wholly devoted here has in view keeping the covenant. It's that covenant relationship. And it's in that view of being complete, perfect. The word used here of wholly devoted can be used or is used elsewhere in other ways of looking at something that's complete or perfect. A stone before it's been sawn in two, that is a whole stone, complete stone. When all the monies that were necessary were accounted for, it was complete. So it's in that sense of being perfect, complete. But as it's used in this context, it's looking at the covenant relationship, that it's complete, that it's perfect, that it's whole devotion. We saw this earlier in 1 Kings 8:61. In the exhortation, Solomon's exhortation to the people, "Let your heart therefore be wholly devoted to the Lord our God." That was Solomon's exhortation at the dedication of the temple. Let your heart be wholly devoted. Chapter 11, verse 4. "For it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away from other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted as the heart of David had been." See, this whole devotion, this complete devotion, this focus that Solomon knew that the nation needed, he stepped away from. But Asa, a great-great-great-grandson, would sit upon the throne, and he would be one of the few that would have a heart wholly devoted to God. If you wanted to use an analogy, he would be like a stone that's never been cut. He's complete. But all the other kings, except for a handful, in some sense would be either cut right down the middle or chipped off. They would not be able to be described as perfect, complete in that devotion. Well, it would be some years, but Hezekiah would be on the throne. Hezekiah, he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among all those who were before him. For he clung to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments which the Lord had commanded Moses. And that's in 2 Kings chapter 18. The word we want to focus on here with Hezekiah is clung. The thought that might come to your mind is, oh, this sounds very much like the passage out of Genesis. That supposed to cling to your wife, and that's the same concept. It's to cleave, to cling, to stick to stick with, to follow closely, to catch, keep close to, join. It is to adhere to. In some passages, it has the sense of clinging to someone in affection and loyalty, such as man is to cleave to his wife. Ruth clung to Naomi. There was a time when the men of Judah clung to David, their king, during a rebellion.
And unfortunately, it says Solomon held fast to these many wives he had. That's the same word. See, it can be in that sense of devotion, affection. But it's also of cleaving to the Lord in affection and devotion and loyalty. We see all the different passages, or we could look at them, where the exhortation is to cling. Deuteronomy 10, it speaks of this same concept of that we need to cling to the Lord. It says, "You shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve Him and cling to Him." See, that's the exhortation, to serve God. Fear God. Cling to God. That's what we're called to do. Hezekiah clung to the Lord. Just as Samuel had held fast to all the wives of foreign nations, all the alliances he'd made, all the women he had collected with their own gods, and he held fast to them, Hezekiah held fast to Yahweh. This is Moses had written in the second law in Deuteronomy saying, you need to hold fast to Yahweh. Hezekiah held fast. He clung. He stuck with the Lord. Well, there's a third king, Josiah. 1 Kings 22, Josiah did right in the sight of the Lord and walked in all the way of his father David, nor did he turn aside to the right or to the left. This did not turn aside in this context affirms that he was steadfast to the Lord. Steadfast to the Lord. Actually, it's... If you noticed in the previous verse, and I kind of had it highlighted but skipped over, where it said that Hezekiah did not depart. It's the same word. It's the same word. Here it has added to it the right and the left, and so it's translated a little different. The idea of departing, it definitely involves or could involve spiritual issues. When you look at in Kings and you look at the kings of Israel, every king of Israel is described as that he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam. They held fast to the sins of Jeroboam. They held fast to a wrong worship of Yahweh. But here, Hezekiah and Josiah, they hold fast to Yahweh. They do not depart from following Yahweh. As one writer says here, unfortunately, those who had departed not from following the Lord were all too few. All too few. As far as kings were concerned, there were only four of them. In 500 years, only four of them. That truly could be described in that ultimate sense. The turn aside phrase, it's often used of Israel's apostasy. It's a way of affirming man's steadfastness to the Lord. Sometimes, and in this case, it's joined together with the the phrase, the root of the right hand, left hand. And thus it said here that he doesn't turn aside. You know, he doesn't depart. He doesn't move in the right, left. It's like this straight, narrow path he's on. Again, in Deuteronomy, we're told, using similar words of what this relationship should be like, it says, "Let me pass through your land. I will travel only on your highway. I will not turn aside to the right or to the left." See, in a physical sense, saying, "Hey, if you'll let me go, I'll stay on the road. If you'll let me pass through your land, I won't get off. We'll stay right on the road. We won't go off the ditch. We won't go out in the field and pick your crops. We will stay right here." Well, in a spiritual sense, that's what it's saying to these two kings. They don't turn aside. Well, here's three kings. If you would, three traits. We look at those traits to be wholly devoted, to cling, and not depart. You know, that sounds pretty simplistic. 500 years, only four kings are described that way. Now, some of these kings we're not given a lot of information about. Hezekiah, we know he makes, you know, an unwise alliance. We're just not told all the information about these. David, we're given a lot of information about. You know, I mean, comparatively speaking, David, David was a guy that, you know, he blew it, coming and going at times. You know, the major issue with David was the sin with Bathsheba when he slept with her. The adulterous relationship, and then he tried to cover it up by having her husband murdered. And that, though Scripture never states it, the writer seems to put it in a category that because David never could really deal with that issue in his life, that he had a hard time dealing with similar issues in his children's life. And David's family was dysfunctional at best. Solomon, under Bathsheba, seems to almost be the exception. She appeared to be a spectacular mother. But David had struggles, even at the time of his death. It's said that this son that's trying to take over knows Solomon's supposed to be king, but he's putting himself in position to be king. Said David never crossed him. You know, David wasn't a great father. So how is it that God can put David up here and say, "Hey, be like David"? Say, "Well, wait a minute, Lord, you mean you want me to commit adultery? No, be like David. Oh, you want me to be a bad father? No, be like David." What is it about David? It's that David never followed another god. See, I struggled. I always never could really figure out this thing about be like David when David is not the perfect person, though we know nobody's perfect, but we're kind of like, well, maybe he could have found somebody a little more perfect, or maybe he could just not told us all those details. And it's not to get to the point of saying, oh, those things don't matter. That would really be foolish. Because we see the consequence in the lives of people when they commit sin. And Scripture does not hesitate to show us David's sin, nor the consequences. But he still is this king that's set up and said, they weren't quite like David. Oh, they were pretty good, but they didn't meet David's standards. But these three met David's standards. Well, what is that standard they met?
Not that they were perfect, not that they didn't sin, and not to try to make light of that, but within the book of Kings, what it is they followed Yahweh. They didn't go after other gods. They didn't go after other gods. 500 years. And there's only four? I mean, there were other good kings, a few, but they weren't put on this level. Most of the kings, all the kings of Israel were bad. Half the kings, well, more than half, a little over half the kings of Judah were either not good or evil. The last kings were evil. And the nation ends in destruction. We look at 2 Kings at the end, and God said with Manasseh what was going to happen. He told Josiah, well, it's, you know, I'll give a break. You know, because of you, this won't happen. And in your lifetime, because your heart was tender, he says. But it's gonna come. And you know, he ends up saying it'll be a devastation. Just like he said earlier, it will happen. And then Nebuchadnezzar comes in and he tears the temple down, and it is a pile of rocks, like God said it would be. And the glory of the temple, God's not there. All the gold's gone, the bronze is gone, everything's gone. In chapter 25 and verse 21, at the very end, it says, so Judah was led away into exile from its land. The third captivity. There's not much left. Now, as for the people who were left, Nebuchadnezzar appointed one to be king, be governor. See, we've left now. No more kings. Not appointing somebody else to be king. You're just a governor now. There is no nation at all. Not even for the last 20 years. It's been a puppet nation under Babylon. But now it's not even that. And then all these different kind of people that had some kind of authority, different powers or people that set up themselves to be a power, they swore allegiance to this governor. Middle of verse 24, it says, do not be afraid of the servants of the Chaldeans. Live in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it will be well with you. However, a few months later, he was murdered by the group that said, don't fear. All will be well. And then they all run off. Verse 26, then all the people, both the small and the great and the captains of the forces, arose and went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans. And then the chapter ends, the book ends telling us that after 37 years, Jehoiakim, who had been taken captive, one of the early captivities, 37 years in captivity, he's released in kind of a, with certain privileges in Babylon. He's given a mill allowance and he has a measure of freedom. That's how the book ends. All the days of his life. Help. Kings ends with the destruction of the nation. And the one king that had been taken into captivity was still alive reminds us that he was a prisoner for 37 years. Never was really free. And nobody's in the land anymore. those that had any.
I mean, all the people of real power were taken out. Those that had assumed a little power and had a little bit there, you know, they murdered one another and then they ran off. Complete destruction. And that's how it ends. Now, the book was not written as a history to, you know, whoever comes after, like we might read of a history of some nation. No, it was written to the returning people, the remnant. It's telling of their spiritual heritage. So since they're still here, there's a heritage. But what are you supposed to learn from this? You know, the one thing that you better learn from it, if you're in that remnant, if you're returning to Jerusalem, if you're going to be a part of the rebuilding of this nation, the thing you better learn is what four kings understood. Don't turn after other gods. Be wholly devoted. Don't decide that you need to be like the nations and worship whatever. And we live in a time when to be spiritual is okay. That's a good thing. Oh, you're spiritual? Oh, wonderful to be a spiritual person. Oh, you go to church? Oh, wonderful. As long as you don't mention that exclusive Jesus person. You know, as long as you leave the exclusive Jesus out of it, it's okay. They were very much like the time of the kings. And we don't have totem poles, and people aren't necessarily worshiping idols in that sense, but there's all kinds of things to worship. And even within what at some point would have been described as Christianity, mainstream Orthodox Christianity, and it still would be used that term loosely, God keeps being redefined. What do you think Jeroboam did? What was the sins of Jeroboam? He redefined God. He didn't want to have a different God. He wasn't out to start a different religion. He just said, hey, instead of us going to Jerusalem, let's put a golden calf over here and we can worship it. He starts redefining God. And we have that happening all the time now in Christian circles. God is being redefined. We remake God in our image. The challenge before us is no different than the challenge that was facing those that were returning to the land. And they're reading 1 and 2 Kings. And they're looking at their spiritual heritage. And when they get through, they go, wow, that didn't end very well, did it? That was pretty exciting, you know. Early on when we were reading this about, you know, I mean, the people were stupid enough to want a king. You know, that wasn't very smart. But, you know, okay, they got past that. But, you know, actually, if you're reading Kings, they start with the kings. And you see, oh, wow. Solomon comes on the throne following David. And wow, look, it goes way up here. Wow, wow, wow. Ooh, that's quite a fall. And what comes after it? Just more of the same, more of the same, more of the same, more of the same. Somewhere there's a refrain in here. If you follow foreign gods, it doesn't come work out well. I mean, for two reasons. Two real simple reasons. One, they ain't real. And if they're not real, what are they going to do for you? And secondly, it's an affront to the true living God. And so we ought to be in that same position now as them, as we're looking and saying, okay, what's our spiritual heritage? You know, as we look and say, what's our spiritual heritage? What are we going to leave behind us? And we used to, you know, we haven't sang it in a long time, this song, you know, all who come behind us, will they find us faithful? Well, if you want to reword it for this one, all who come behind us, will they find us wholly devoted to God? Not, you know, not reading into that all that we might read in our culture, you know, positive culture of, you know, discipleship and all this, but seeing that as meaning you don't pursue other gods. And I'm not trying to be simplistic and say, you know, sin doesn't matter. I'm saying if you don't have that focus on God to begin with, you can be sure all the other is going to come. You know, I was trying to think this morning, and, you know, I'm getting old. That's obvious. And my memory is slipping, I guess. But I can't remember a time we weren't in Kings. And I'm regretting there's not a third Kings, because I'm not sure what, you know, what I'm going to do now, because all I know how to do is read Kings. But it's the same story. I mean, for over a year now, you've heard the same story every week. Except it's so uniquely presented, it's never the same. Well, I may have made it the same, but the Bible doesn't make it the same. But when you get finished with it and you look back, what's it about? It's not about the history. It's about a spiritual history. And it's about a disappointing spiritual history of when people went after other gods. Now, I don't know this factually. I've heard it said, and it is interesting. You know, in a cursory reading, you don't really see it. So it may be true. After the nation returns to the land, they never pursue foreign gods. Idolatry is never an issue with Israel again. And when you think of at the time of Christ, idolatry is not an issue. Jesus is not confronting people of the land with all their idolatry. He's confronting them with righteousness. He's confronting them with not, you know, worshiping God the way God is said to be worshipped, various things like this, but it's not about other gods. You know, in the captivity, they did learn something, evidently. Reading Kings, they evidently learned something. But we need to be careful that we do not fall into that. If Solomon was the wisest man to ever live, and he was stupid enough to marry women that had other gods and let them influence him, we better not think we're just all that secure. Oh, that could never happen to me. Don't mean it in a threat. Don't mean it in a sense of, like, you know, be paranoid. You know, we have to be diligent. That it's not likely that any of us are going to worship some idol. But we need to be careful that we don't fall into some redefined God, that we don't fall into some sense of spirituality that's outside of Christianity. We don't fall into something that's outside of what the Bible is calling us to. That God is God, that He is the God of Abraham, the God of Jesus Christ, not some God that we've manufactured because it's more convenient. We live in a time when to be spiritual is great, as long as that spirituality is not exclusively about Jesus Christ and Yahweh. The challenge. You know, before us, three little phrases that we could perhaps think about this week and ask ourselves, you know, whole devotion. You know, complete, not cut and peeled, not divided, whole devotion. To cling. And not to turn aside, not to depart. Obviously, if you cling, you don't depart. If you're wholly devoted, you didn't turn aside. So it ends up being three synonyms. Whichever one you like best, they all mean the same. They described David, but unfortunately, it didn't describe Solomon. And because of that, we have kings, a divided nation. Will you stand with me as we close the prayer? Father, it's such a challenge to to live in this world. Sometimes everything's so smooth and easy and life is fun and life is just seems simple. Other times the challenges seem to come quicker than we can catch our breath. And much of it's somewhere in between. Father, help us not to be complacent. Help us not to be apathetic. Help us not to be naive, but to be those that join this small group of great kings that were wholly devoted, that clung to you, that did not depart. They worshiped you and you alone. Let that be our refrain. And we do pray in Christ's name.